Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us this week for a conversation with Francois Michelon. Francois is a CEO of Indra Life Sciences and joined the organization as CEO and successfully took it into an IPO on the NASDAQ in 2017. He has a background working in Fortune 20 companies as well as VC-funded startups. He has an undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago in economics as well as an MBA from Carnegie Mellon. We're looking forward to our conversation with Francois. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us for a conversation today with Francois Michelon. We connected a number of years ago. It's been a number of years that we've had conversation, and it's great to have you with us today and appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great. Well, first off, can you give us a little bit of your kind of an overview of your career and talk a little bit about what it was like to leave school and kind of launch out and talk to us about that?
My pleasure. Sure. My parents were French immigrants. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which some people are surprised about with my background, but grew up there. I have an undergraduate degree in economics from the University of Chicago, and I went on for my MBA back in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon. And I started my med tech career in the mid-90s at GE Medical Systems, as it was called, before it became GE Healthcare in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So another glamorous place after Pittsburgh.
Sure.
And I spent about 8 years there. And, you know, it was in a series of roles, HR, Six Sigma, e-commerce, and marketing. And in the 1990s and 2000s, GE was a great place for professional development for a young business leader like myself. There was a very strong corporate culture focused on execution. I loved that. And, you know, back then it was run by Jack Welch. Jeff Immelt was running the medical business. The business was doing very, very well. And it was really a culture of about 20% strategy or aim and 80% execution, pull the trigger. And if you failed in your mission, small or large, you were expected to learn quickly and to grow as a leader. And I it's not necessarily the right place for everyone, but for me, it felt really good. It was very execution and hands-on. At GE, for 4 out of the 8 years, I was offered a job in the x-ray business. And the x-ray business at the time was the three-headed stepchild of imaging. It just wasn't as appealing to most people as CT or MRI, which was very high-tech, very software-driven. X-ray was still in the film world. They were transitioning to digital. But I joined and I took a risk because it was run by a great leader who eventually became my mentor, a gentleman named Dan Kerpelman. And, you know, it was one of those experiences, Mark, that just confirmed for me what I've experienced throughout my career, that more than 50% of a job is who you work with. Mm. And so I really enjoyed that. I left GE to take on my first leadership role at Smith & Nephew. And so that was in Boston. I spent about another 7 years there. And I had a very interesting mission. It was to build a for-profit service business from their repair and installation operations. So installing, repairing, and training the clinical staff on all the surgical equipment, the minimally invasive surgical cameras, endoscopes, image management systems, all the stuff that enables surgeons to see inside the body. And it was a lot of fun. It was really my first taste of building a new business, developing new offerings, hiring a team, engaging the global sales channels. And, you know, for me, one of the most interesting jobs I've probably had until reaching Indra here. And we grew that from virtually nothing to $55 million or so in revenue and good, solid, like 15% EBITDA, which at the time was good. So very interesting. Then concurrently took over a turnaround to fix an ailing division of products for the visualization capital systems, a lot of the products that I was actually servicing. And that that line of business was suffering very negative profitability. The capital markets were tough. People were not investing in new capital. And so it was a much different mission than growing a business, less creative, a lot more of rationalizing the portfolio, reducing staff, and spinning off even some parts of the business to Steris Corporation. But we turned it around, pretty proud to say, I think we're at negative 10% EBITDA when we started, and we bumped it up about 15 points to 5 or so percent positive EBITDA. So it went from bleeding money to making a little money, and you know that was tough, but very interesting for me. Sure. And then I joined Biomet. Biomet, another large orthopedic division. I became head of marketing for their dental division. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the dental market was not a space I was particularly interested in, but there was a great leader, Maggie Anderson, who I believe is now at DaVita, who was running that division. And I took a leap of faith, and it was a very interesting couple of years. That sector, the dental sector, was under enormous pressure from low price value players that were eroding the market. And it was another period of taking some, you know, pretty drastic cost reduction actions, but also changing the business, turning it into a more nimble e-commerce-based business to be able to compete with some of those more price-focused companies. So another interesting rotation with, you know, diagnostic imaging and x-ray, orthopedics and sports medicine and services at Smith & Nephew, and now in dentistry and dental implants at Biomet. We were subsequently acquired by a large competitor, Zimmer, and I went, as the British say, on gardening leave, which is another way to say I was without a job. And, you know, first time in my life that I really had to think about what did I really want to do next. I was approaching 50. It happens to a lot of good people, but you start to doubt yourself. And what do I want to do? Do I want to continue in this large corporate commercial environment, or is there something else? And that's when I, through my network, was introduced to someone at Endra Life Sciences. It was a completely undercapitalized little company. And I think in hindsight, it's good that I was naive about how bad it was when I joined, because I might not have joined had I really understood the situation. But, you know, it was the right time, the right place. I believed in the company, the technology, the clinical value proposition. And I jumped in. And I will tell you, the next 2 years were probably the most difficult years of my life, both professionally and in many ways personally. Getting people to write you a check on Wall Street is very, very different than earning your piece of the pie during the budgeting process at GE or anywhere else. And we schlepped our goods all over the place, trying to find private capital, trying to find public capital. And we got a lot of no's. And it taught me that, you know, first of all, a lot of good companies disappear. Mm-hmm. Even though they have value, they just don't make it across the goal line. It also taught me that when you represent an opportunity in a capital formation environment, it's very different than when you're in a budgeting exercise at GE or elsewhere. It's got to have a crisp, emotional, clinical, financial call to action and appeal. And you don't get 2 hours to tell your story. You get 30 minutes in front of a very busy portfolio manager. But we did it. I mean, after 2 years of hundreds of no's, extended periods of no paycheck, and my wife telling me, get a job, dude. We got it across the goal line. And we had a successful IPO on the NASDAQ, which was quite early for a pre-revenue company like ours. Mm-hmm. Not typical path to capital formation, but, you know, an enormous amount of legitimacy and cost associated. But it's enabled us, with the rigor that NASDAQ expects, to have enormous transparency and liquidity in the markets as we raise more funds going forward. And it's really been a wonderful exercise. And for me, Mark, as someone who's now in his early 50s, as hard as the work is, I've never felt more energized because I'm learning every day. You know, I spend the first part of my career managing P&Ls and top line roles in business, but they were all corporate roles. Here, this is really being an owner of a very small, high growth, very lean business. And I had never done an IPO. And you know, you learn every day. So that's kind of the background. And I've droned on too long, but you can edit this as you feel appropriate.
That's good. So the big question is, would you do what you just did again?
Yeah, I would say whatever happens at Endra, I don't think I'll ever go back to the corporate world. I mean, I love the innovation, the pace, the ownership of a small company. Sure, there's the financial wealth creation potential, but that if that's what drives you, there are probably easier ways to make money.
Right.
But I really believe in our technology, and I don't want to promote that here, but you know, if you don't believe really deeply in what you're doing, it's going to come out when you're seeking money. Investors are going to ask you, do you have your own money invested, which I do. You know, how much skin in the game do you really have? And I love that. It's a very genuine, direct, hard way to live a business, as opposed to being, you know, a VP of marketing or something in another company where you have other challenges, but you don't have that same immediacy. So yeah, I think I would do it again.
Great. Well, if you were able to go back to that 22-year-old Francoise, he was thinking about the future and was excited about it. With what you know now, what advice would you give him?
That's a great question. I would try to kick myself in the pants and listen more and speak less, because you learn a lot in listening. I would emphasize what I still feel today and what I originally mentioned about the culture at GE, that don't overthink it. Be execution focused. Unless you want to be a consultant, which is a fine profession, if you're going to be in the pit and a doer, you're never going to have perfect information. You've got to deal with ambiguity. And as I mentioned, if you pull the trigger and you miss, learn quickly. And I think tied to that, you know, if you make a mistake, admit it, don't pass the buck. And I found that that tends to quell finger pointers very quickly. If you say, you know what, I goofed, but here's what I'm going to do about it, or here's the remediation to that, you don't beat a dead horse, you move on. And I find that to be refreshing in people, to have a certain self-awareness to say, hey, I'm better at this and not good at that. And so I'd say, listen more, speak less, focus on execution, and admit when you're wrong.
Yeah. Is there any advice that you received early on that you now, in hindsight, would have ignored?
You know, I think I had too many times I heard people say, you've got to get the right job. And yeah, that's kind of easy to say, but I think taking that glamorous job in CT or MRI, for example, at the time at GE was probably the right way to go. And if you either have a personal sort of attraction to the technology, or you believe there's a potential somewhere that's less glamorous, and you feel you can have an impact and it develops you, it's not more of the same, then I would say take a job that develops you, be it lateral or vertical growth or not, but learn along the way. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question. So I wouldn't listen and try to just get the right next job.
Sure.
It's got to be right for you.
Yeah. Any books that you would say are must reads that you've had an impact on you?
Couple come to mind. 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel is an interesting book. It's a pretty extreme book, but I think the philosophy that you should be focused on creating something new and definitively new, going from 0 to 1, as opposed to refining and just improving on something, going from 1 to N, resonates with me in a startup. We're trying to do something completely new, introduce a brand new technology that doesn't exist. Incredibly hard, but if we're successful, we change the game. It really, I hate to use the old, you know, paradigm shift jargon of the 90s and 2000s, but changing that game in some manner is really important. And I think it also emphasizes being the best at a very few number of things, mm-hmm. rather than being just good or, God forbid, average at a lot of things. As I think of my son and daughter, one is in college, one is applying to college, you know, they're trying to be superstars in sports and academics and extracurriculars. And I think now I've learned the lesson with one kid getting into college that it's better to just be highly differentiated in one area. And I think it translates to professional lives, not to be the general manager who's pretty good at everything, but to be really good at a few number of things. Love biographies and history, and a biography on Churchill by Gilbert, I thought was fascinating because it too kind of relates to careers and the challenges you face. It mm-hmm. showed me this man, Winston Churchill, who, you know, had an incredibly long life politically and biologically, and who faced enormous challenges, enormous political challenges, military defeats, poor health, heart attacks, depression. But he was that visionary that saw the writing on the wall with Hitler. Everybody said, you're wrong. He kept pushing and he got Britain through the war. And I think, you know, clearly was instrumental in the Allies winning. And I don't know how he did it, but I look to that guy and I think, you know, he had everything against him and what a life he led, but he persisted and he believed in something. So I think that's another very interesting book.
Any other books that stand out?
You know, there's another one, a little faster read called Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, mm-hmm. which is an interesting book because it talks about thin slicing and really capturing sort of slices of information and processing them more intuitively and trusting that intuition. And I think speaking back to some of the comments we were just discussing about never having a perfect amount of information and being able to, as you grow older, especially, and you have a little more perspective and
right.
History, to trust that intuition as part of the decision-making process. Sometimes it's too easy to do a business case and just convince you of something, but in your gut, you feel one way or another. And I'm learning to do a little more of that gut inclusion in the decision process.
Good. So tell me about, as you were putting together the team for Indra mm-hmm. and other experience that you've had, what advice would you give somebody as they're putting together their first executive team?
Yeah, I spent a couple of years in HR at GE, and human resources at GE is a well-respected strategic function mm-hmm. That's very much at the table. And so it was a great entry point for me, actually. And one of the most important things I took away from that I keep in my operating role is making sure that anyone you talk to gets a realistic job preview. Mm-hmm. It may sound pretty obvious, but I don't think it's done consistently and well. And whether you're hiring a junior level engineer or a C-level executive, giving them a balanced, realistic view of what the job is, in addition to obviously assessing the cultural fit, especially in a small company like ours. We're under 20 staff right now. We're growing, but you know, every person we add can be so complementary or destructive to the innovation and the culture and the collaboration that we have here. So making sure people understand what they're getting into, good and bad. Hopefully it's 51% or more good. You know, it's an attractive job, but no job is perfect. Mm-hmm. And having them understand the risks is not only, I think, the ethical thing to do when you're hiring people, it's also, I think, a good business sense, because the last thing you want is to hire someone and have them leave in 6 months. It's an enormous amount of energy, financial investment, time to bring someone on, and then if they flame out because they didn't like the job, shame on you. So I think though that's something I always think about. I like to have. I know it sounds politically motivated, but I really believe this, as diverse a team as I can. And in our team, we're certainly striving for more diversity, but I don't mean just diversity of, of ages or ethnicities or gender. Although in Endra, we have an 83-year-old software engineer who is absolutely amazing at his job and worked on missile guidance systems during the Eisenhower administration, if you can believe it. And
that's amazing.
I am, every day I'm impressed by this guy. But getting that diversity, I think, gives you a range of perspectives that help you make better decisions. I really worry about having a bunch of type 1A3s or whatever code you want to assign to the same type of person sitting around the table and missing a perspective on something. So having a range of backgrounds, a range of experiences, and even ages, for me, is something that's very attractive to having high-performing team.
Any favorite interview questions that you like to ask?
I sometimes ask people, if I spoke to one of your peers, what would they say you're not very good at? I think when people tell you something that sounds very canned, like I work too hard or something like that, it doesn't show a lot of self-awareness.
Sure.
And so I like to see self-awareness. I like to kind of put it in a way, as opposed to asking someone directly, hey, what do you think your maybe a development need is? Having them step out of themselves a little bit and think about Jim or Jane or someone that might be answering that on their behalf. It sometimes prompts some introspection and self-awareness, sometimes doesn't, but I don't like to play games in an interview. I like to really get to know people. I like to understand the drivers and if there are failures there or perceived failures, what happened? What did you learn? Coming back to that message that we started on, Mark, I think it's okay to fail. But did you learn something from it? And are you making excuses about it, or did it just happen? And I think that's very important. Yeah. These are great.
No. So anything in the last, and I know there's a lot that's happened in the last 5 years in your life, but any new behavior, habit that you've developed that you wish you would have started earlier?
Nothing rocket science. I will tell you what works for me is getting up every day at roughly the same time, between 6 and 6:30 every day, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, vacation, you name it, getting up every day at the same time. On the weekends, the rest of the family is sleeping. It allows me to have a little bit of quiet downtime. But that keeps my biological clock, circadian rhythm, sort of in tune. I find that if I deviate too much from that, it throws me off half the week. So sorry to be unoriginal.
Any apps or technology that have made you more productive?
A couple of things come to mind. One is reasonably high tech. The other one is decidedly low tech. But the thing that amazes me, I mean, obviously, we're all connected, laptops and phones and even video conferencing as we're doing now, which we use regularly with our dispersed team. But one of the things I find most useful as an app is a document scanner. It's not new technology, but having the ability to PDF a document, a legal document that you've signed, and you're, instead of faxing it or mailing it back or going to a scanner and emailing it to someone, being able to do that right from your phone, I forget the name of it, but there are numerous versions of it, super useful, not just for legal documents, but for receipts, for anything you see that an article, instead of ripping it out or copying it, great storage and doc management tool. The other thing that I was thinking of it when you asked the question that's decidedly low tech is I travel a lot. I have this Briggs & Riley suitcase. that cost me about four times what a regular roll-on should cost. And I took the bait from the salesperson, but it has this amazing compression system that allows you to crush down like over a week's worth of clothing into a little tiny carry-on. And it's, you know, it's probably a pretty volatile bag of pressure, but it works great. And I use that every day and I never have to check a bag. So yeah, that's something that I use. And every day I'm amazed. Wow, I got all that stuff in there and I still don't have to check it.
Do you have to stand back away from when you pretty open much. It up that it explodes?
It's close to that, but I love that.
Cool.
You know, it's you ask, and I keep thinking, what do you use almost every day? I mean, I travel every week somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm in our headquarters in Ann Arbor today, but usually I'm on the East Coast or the West Coast, and we'll be launching our first product in Europe this year, and so I'll be in Europe quite a lot. And those little things, the scanning app or the luggage that works, make your life a little bit easier.
Sure.
This has been a lot of fun, Mark, just catching up like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, any parting advice that you would give to someone?
You know, for me, the most resonating thing was this recent success with our IPO. And I took away a lot of the messages we've discussed here, that if you really believe in something and you're willing to commit and go above and beyond what is probably rational in some cases, you can achieve things that are pretty, I think, unusual. And we had so many failures getting to this point. And I think there was real belief. There was a lot of grit and persistence. And there was certainly luck. There always is some luck. But if you believe in something and you bust your butt, I think it can happen for more people than, you know, think. And I would encourage anyone to kind of persist in the face of Churchillian, you know, pushback in the world. Just keep at it. Because if not, you kind of check back into, without denigrating anything else, you know, a paycheck and a job. Having that passion for something is something I've kind of discovered a little late in life, but you earn it. And I hope it comes through in my tone. I still don't listen enough. I still talk too much, but that's your fault. You're making me chat.
Well, it's definitely, I've enjoyed our conversation today, Francois, and
thank
wish you
Mark.
Continued success at Indra and that you would hit all the milestones and the goals that you have. And we definitely enjoyed your conversation.
Pleasure, Mark. Thanks so much for taking time to chat with me and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.